Department of Economics at the New School. Anu's latest book was Globalization and the Myth of Free Trade, which came out in 2007. He was the author with Ahmet Tonak of Measuring the Wealth of Nations, Political Economy of National Accounts. And his paper, which I think he's talking about from today to some degree, it's called The First Great Depression of the 21st Century, and it just came out in Socialist Register 2011. Everybody here, all of our speakers are doing books on the crisis and so forth. And Anu's is called your book.
It's not quite on the crisis, but anyway, it's called Turbulent Dynamics and Hidden Patterns: Economic Analysis in a Global Context.
Okay. So, Anu, without further ado, I'm working.
Thank you. I want to make two points because this presentation is somewhat compressed, and I want to relate it to events in two different dimensions. One is a kind of historical dimension. I don't call this the current crisis. I call it a recurrent crisis. And this is an important distinction because it makes it clear that this is something built into the dynamic of capitalist accumulation itself, a point well recognized every 40 years or so. And as Galbraith says, we remember it until we have been taught to forget it, and then it comes back. So I want to talk a little bit about that, but in a sketchy way, because I want to focus largely on what's happening now. And the other part, the other end of that bracket, is the global context, particularly the question for me, which is the large reserve army of labor on a global scale. The increasing numbers of people, especially young people, who are cut out of any prospect. Last night, after talking to Bob, I went back and did some calculations, which I had done before, but I sort of firmed up on how long it would take for the current reserve army of labor, which is on the order of 1 billion people, unemployed or underemployed on a world scale. Strong correlation between that and poverty on a world scale. What rate of growth would global capitalism have to achieve at historical levels of productivity growth and population growth, which is quite low now, to absorb that reserve army of labor, counting the new people coming in. And the time unit I want to refer to is the one Mubarak, which is a 30-year time dimension. And roughly at 4%, it takes two Mubaraks, and at 5%, it takes one Mubarak. But at the current rate, the reserve army rises because, of course, productivity growth is roughly equal to population growth and all the difference in GDP and growth and population growth, so that you have, in fact, no pickup of the reserve army. That has huge implications, which I think as economists we need to think about more systematically. Having said that,
I thought it was a security force that was cut out.
Well, let me set the tone for this while we're talking. I want to make a specific argument about the relation between the existing crisis and the recurrence. Now, I can't do, in 35 minutes, I can do a very limited amount, and now less than 35 minutes. So let me just lay out the basic argument. I want to argue that, perhaps not a controversial point, that capitalism is driven by profitability and not by, having trouble going down here. that is driven by profitability, and particularly in a way that economists have long recognized but not built into models very well, which is the idea that it's the difference between the profit rate and
people should just use Mac if they went out.
Yeah, I agree.
Use a charge, just plug it in.
Yeah.
When down. Does it allow you to close the application and then do it?
Close it and
run it.
Yeah, as soon as I mentioned that, everything, the power went down, internet access went down, after that the... I got to Ellie's talk.
We're going to let him do that.
Yes, I could read his talk.
Hey.
Hey.
Okay.
Oh, right. Forget the time units. I want to argue that something quite extraordinary happened in the so-called Great Recovery, which took place in the 80s with Reagan and Thatcher and all of that. And that was the confluence of two events which are crucial for profitability, for this idea of accumulation being driven by the difference between profit rate and the interest rate, what Marx calls the profit of enterprise. Keynes's essential description of that is the source of the animal spirits of capitalism, because it's the difference between the total return and the cost, in effect, of capital or passive return, as Marx puts it. Well, those two things moved in extraordinarily different ways in that period. The profit rate had been falling until about the 1980s, 82, and then after that essentially stabilized because of an enormous increase in productivity relative to labor, or to put it another way, an increase in the rate of exploitation of labor, and we'll see that data in a minute. But that alone only stabilized the falling profit rate. It didn't cause it to turn around. And the other thing, which is truly extraordinary on a world scale, is an unprecedented drop in interest rates. And you'll see those pictures. But the point is that those two, a rise in the rate of exploitation and a drop in the cost of capital, sparked a boom. But a boom that was attended by bubbles, inevitably, with this falling cost of capital, which meant not only the borrowing from the consumer sector and the business sector, but real estate and finance bubbles. And those bubbles inflated the system, so to speak, carried upward, but of course they had an unstable base, and that brought the whole system down. So with that in mind, it's obvious that what I'm arguing is the mortgage crisis was not the cause of the crisis. On the contrary, it was a local phenomena, which was where the crisis first burst, but it doesn't follow in a sense that it was that cause which, had it not occurred, everything would have been fine. Yeah, something else would have been the trigger of the crisis. And of course, deregulation has often been blamed, but of course, we have to remember, deregulation is being pushed by the capitalist sector itself. Financial sectors, banks were pushing very hard to be allowed into the profit that they were locked out of by previous rounds of regulation, and they managed to persuade, which isn't very hard to persuade senators and congressmen to side with them. And of course, then you had the fact that they were involved in it in a deeper way than in many other countries. Now, I won't have time to talk about this recurrence phenomenon, but I just want to mention that the term Great Depression is surprisingly old. You find it referring to the 1840s, 1880s, 1930s, and I would argue the 1970s, which is often called the Great Stagflation. Some of these were sharp contractions and the others were drawn out, but they all involve some characteristic patterns, which is a kind of rebalancing of the economy by wiping out businesses, wiping out jobs, reducing real wages relative to productivity, all the things that Marx talks about as a characteristic crisis phenomenon, concentration, centralization, devalorization of capital, and so on. And I believe that we're entering that. Now, as I said, for me, the main point is profitability is the driver of growth. But to put it another way, effective demand is effective when it offers profitability. It's not effective if you go to a business and say, I will buy 10,000 tanks. I don't know why tanks come to my mind easily, but I will buy 10,000 tanks at a cost below their, at a price below their cost. You get no supply whatsoever. If you raise it above their cost and the profit rises, then of course the willingness to supply increases. The first set of graphs is just to remind you that the object of this kind of discussion is capitalism, not what Marx said, not what Keynes said, not what Minsky said or Kolesky said, but the system itself. And it's good to know what it looks like. Here's a picture of industrial production from 1860 to 2004, and you see that characteristically capitalism is a growing system, and it's turbulent in its growth. Its dynamics are intrinsically turbulent dynamics. This is a lovely set of graphs taken from Leonard Ayres. It's called The Turning Point of Business Cycles. And it shows you the different ups and downs. In his book, which I couldn't duplicate here because it's too dense, every upturn has a name that was given at that time. The newspapers, the Rich Man's Panic of 1852, or you know, the corn crisis or whatever. But the characteristic pattern is these ups and downs. They're not mechanical, regular, but they are what I would call recurrent. And this idea of recurrence is very important because it's tied to the idea of the recurrence of the depression. So that first period is 1831 to 1862. The next one is 1867 to 1902. And the other thing I want to point out is that every once in a while you'll see in each one of these periods, a period called the Great Depression. So here, this we're looking at the 1840s, then 1870s, then, of course, the 1930s. And this is as far as his data goes, so I can't take it further. So let me now come to the patterns that I was talking about. This is the profit rate of non-financial corporations, the general rate of profit. And you can see its general patterns until the 1980s. And you also see in the middle this big boom, which is, of course, related to the Vietnam War. Deficit spending and increasing government spending. Wars are generally good for economies until you lose, and then they're not so good, as you can see. But what is quite striking is that this profit rate, after the 1980s, period of the great boom of capitalism in that subsequent so-called recovery period, the profit rate is essentially flat. It fluctuates a lot, but it's flat. All of this data, by the way, is on my homepage, which I, if you type in my name and type economist, you will pick up my homepage, otherwise Shake Economist. The second quite striking thing is the movement of the interest rate. Beginning in 1947, you see this huge rise of the interest rate, and the so-called Volcker shock is a very small part of that general rise. And then this enormous decline, this really quite striking decline in the interest rate, which I would argue was a tremendous source of fuel for the animal spirits of capital because it made their net profit rate higher, even though they were not able to raise their intrinsic profit rate very they were only able to stabilize. It's important to understand that this took place on a world scale. So what we did is we calculated the world interest rate, which is the weighted interest rate of U.S. trading partner, and you can see the parallelism between the U.S. rate and the world rate. And an interesting question arises. Is the U.S. rate driving the world rate, or is the world rate driving the U.S. rate, or there are common elements driving both, which is my own bias in this, but in any case, that's a question worth investigating. So this then brings us to that key variable, which is the profit rate of enterprise. It's the difference between the profit rate and the interest rate. It's that thing that capital is most concerned about, which is the excess of its rate of return over what it would get from passive holding on of the money that it's thrown in and may not get back, by the way, when it's thrown into circulation. And you can see this profit rate of enterprise declines very steadily, really, from the beginning of the 1947 post-war period. And here's the crisis of the 70s. It even becomes negative at some point because of the inflation effect on interest rates. And then you get this quite sharp recovery that takes place through a combination of factors. I'm going to skip over the profit of enterprise. Here's a graph that tells you something about one of the causes of that recovery, which is the fall off in wages relative to productivity. The dotted line is productivity. And as you see, it grows pretty steadily throughout all those periods, though it slows down in the stagflation crisis of the 60s and 70s. But it's the real effect of that crisis was, in fact, the destruction of labor unions, as we well know, and labor support institutions in the United States, with the consequent slowdown in the growth rate of real wages. So here we have the dotted line, productivity, and here you have this gap, increasing gap between productivity and real wages, which takes place, which is an important source of increasing profitability for capital. It's not enough to reverse the fall, but it's enough to cancel out the fall. And it's quite historically quite extraordinary. It's well known that this was the period of low interest rates where debt income ratios rose a lot, and the interest of sort of keeping to my time limit, I'm going to skip over some of that, but we know that this is the U.S. debt-to-income ratio of households, and you can see that beginning in the 80s, the so-called boom period, was fueled in part by the fact that a huge overextension of consumption took place for U.S. households. And that overextension led ultimately to a retraction, as it must, which is one of the things we're facing now. One of the consequences of a falling interest rate is that you can afford to borrow more. So the debt-to-income ratio rose, but the ratio of debt service, this amortization and interest payments, which your charge card bills, so to speak, didn't rise really till the 90s, when in effect the debt began to catch up and the interest rates had already begun to lower, so that you can't do anything more with that. And we reached a historic peak of close to 14.5%. in 2007, before their pattern began. So I'm arguing some specific things. I'm arguing, and I argue this in more detail in the paper, and I apologize for rushing through it, but I want to lay out the bigger picture, that the recurrence of the Great Depression is an intrinsic outcome. Yeah, if I have time, I will try to show you what I mean by intrinsic. I want to show you the other recurrences. That it's modified in its path and expression by conjunctural factors, including institutional development and particular local events, but it's not determined by a balance of conjunctural factors. It's really driven by the factors that drive profitability, and profitability has a series of built-in mechanisms that drive it. And the second point is that not only do the recurrence of Great Depressions are driven by internal factors, so is the recovery, because Great Depressions set into motion a series of destructive elements which enable the survivors to recover. So I'm not talking about this as the end of capitalism. On the contrary, this is a familiar scenario in some way that has implications on the global scale, which are not recurrent in that same sense. But that the two ones which historically been targeted was the lowering of real wages relative to productivity, or the rate of exploitation, in which the Reserve Army plays a very big role. Now, previously, historically, the Reserve Army was national. Then it became international in the sense that it encompasses the boundaries of nations where the labor could move. But now, of course, it's global in a profoundly different way. And that has many implications, which I think I would love to talk about. And the third is concentration and centralization, which is the wiping out of smaller capitals, taking over them by bigger capitals, the loss of capital value, the collapse of asset value. And this is, of course, also taking place now on a global scale. I don't believe that this is driven by the hegemonic balance of power. And I realize that puts me in an extreme and possibly fatally extreme minority on the left, but I don't believe that that is central, though I do believe that they're crucial for understanding the dynamic. And I don't think it's crucial for understanding the intrinsic patterns, which are driven by something deeper, by profitability itself. I want to talk a little bit about the recovery mechanisms. because I said that I believe that capitalism has its recovery mechanisms. It doesn't follow that these recovery mechanisms are politically tolerable in all historical periods, because, of course, the development of institutions and of the standard living of most people, as well as their ability to react on governments, whose job now becomes to prevent these things, who then are responsible in some sense for their occurrence and their form and their expression, at least since the Great Depression, that's been clear, then raises the question, how is this intrinsic pattern, intrinsic dynamic, modulated by the intervention of the state? What role does the state have in the expression of these patterns, as well as in the elimination of some of their consequences? I don't believe the state can eliminate the pattern, because that would involve it changing the way that profitability works. But I do believe it can modulate the expression. One modulation. In the Great Depression, the unemployment rate was 25%. That's the official unemployment rate. A lot more people were caught up because a lot of people don't get counted in it. Nowadays, the official unemployment rate is 10%. But everybody knows you need to double that number if you want to count those who are underemployed, those who wish to work, those who've given up. On a world scale, you have to more than double that number, maybe triple it, in order to get some idea of what people are really experiencing. So official numbers mean nothing. I think most people know that you're counted as employed if you work 1 hour in the previous week. Now, that's not a definition of employment that's politically very meaningful, and so, of course, you need to talk about underemployment. So that raises a question, which is that in the Great Depression, there were periods after the Depression where there's phenomenal growth, 14% in 1936, for instance. There was a budget deficit, which helped shore up, in spite of the 25% unemployment, there was a budget deficit run by the state. But Roosevelt cut it back in 1937 in response to pressures, and that led to a sharp downturn again, 1938. And that downturn was not really taken back up. He, of course, retracted that cutback, and therefore was able to turn things around a little bit. But it really also, that recovery then was met by another expansion of government expenditures having to do with the build-up for World War II. I'm going to show you some pictures here. So let me start with the picture of the federal budget deficit. You can see that in the 1930s, the federal government ran a deficit, which by now would be considered extraordinarily modest, just less than 2%, but it was considered quite serious at that point. And then there was a surplus, and Roosevelt was persuaded to cut back on government spending on the grounds that now a surplus is there, growth is recovered, everything is fine, the same kind of thing you hear from every administration. And when they did, they had a sharp downturn, and Roosevelt abandoned the cutback. But of course, that's 1938, 1939, and then the government begins its build up for the war. And then you see budget deficits on the order of 12%, which had not been seen before. And everybody was, that was fine, because it was socially a valid cause for budget deficits. Real GDP growth is a parallel of all of this. You have this tremendous growth beginning in 1932 all the way up. These are growth rates, mind you. So the growth rate goes from almost negative 12% all the way up to positive 12%. And then as the cutback and the growth rate drops sharply, become negative again, then the reinstatement of government spending, and you get a rise in the growth rate, and then of course you get that rise that comes with the build up in World War II. So these kinds of patterns are crucially dependent on interventions by the state and by social mobilization. And that brings me to the second last point, which is that social mobilization doesn't require war. I know historically, yes, wars have been the easiest form of social mobilization for lots of obvious reasons, but it doesn't follow that we are required to spend money on war in order to spend money. Two things I think were important in the Roosevelt period. One is the derived employment that came from government spending, which meant that you stimulate business and that provide employment for people. And that's what we would normally call a trickle-down effect. You subsidize the capital itself and you hope that it'll trickle down to jobs. But the Roosevelt government also introduced, as did European governments, by the way, the direct employment of labor, not only in the army, which is an important thing that happened in Europe, but also in explicit employment programs, such as the WPA, which directly employed people. And there was a contradiction, a well-known historical tension between the direct employment of labor and the implications that had for the capitalist class, which didn't like it and never liked it because it undermined the function of the reserve army. The reserve army is functional, and it's undermined that function. And in fact, in that debate, as I'm speaking to historians, so I have to be careful what I say, but my understanding of that debate is that the capitalist class was quite vocal at that historical moment about the bad social and political effects of supporting labor directly. So we often, in the post-war period, that came in focus was on the idea of government spending without specifying the form of the spending, but that's very important to make a distinction between the trickle-down effect and the trickle-up effect. If you employ workers directly, they spend money, and that has an employment and employer, a multiplier effect and all that, but it's coming from the bottom. Whereas if you spend money on businesses, some part of that may lead to more employment if their inventories have been burned off. There's no reason for businesses to produce more if they've been stuck with a lot of inventory. So that's a very slow and irregular. Now, I want to end with a discussion of the present period. There are many demands we made in the developing world, and you can see this expressed so clearly now in Tunisia and Egypt. It's not just about dignity, but the sense that this system has to live up to its promise that it gives a better standard of living for a large majority of people, not just for those at the top. And the top is very visible in those countries. You can see that. I want to talk very briefly to end with this idea of the reserve army of labor, because it's such a crucial conceptual category in Marx, that's such an important functional role, because it's the place where capitalism throws its displaced labor and the place from which it plucks it. But that labor is fed, it's a pool, as Marx puts it, a pool, which is fed by population, but it's also fed by immigration, and it's diminished by employment. And the balance of those two things have changed, in my opinion, dramatically. As I said, the little experiment I did yesterday, which I've often talked about in classes, is the idea to ask ourselves, what would capitalism have to do in the coming period? Assuming that we pass through the recovery, which, by the way, could take 3 to 5 years, and it could take 10 to 12 years. It depends whether it's Japanese style or Reagan-Thatcher style. But assuming there is a recovery in the center, what would that require on a global scale? What rates of growth would we need to come back to some kind of standard living where this massive reserve army of labor is absorbed? And I said the average growth rate of capitalism in the last decade has been on the order of, on the world scale, 2.2%, which is about the growth rate of productivity on a world scale these days. So that just tells you that basically capitalism is not picking up any more than it's displacing. And so the growth rates would have to be around 4% to get 25 to 30 years before the reserve army is absorbed. And it would have to be on the order of average worldwide growth on the order of 5%. These are well outside the bounds of historical growth rates of capitalism. And we know that China and India have been growing at fantastic rates, that countries often do for initial bursts of takeoff. The sustainable growth rates have always been on the order of 3-4%, even in the developed world, by the way. So I want to leave with that question. The crisis we're talking about as we first experienced it is here in the developed world. But we're looking now at people expressing their own sense of the crisis, which is that it's been there for a long time. It's been there in stagnation, in inequality, in standard living, which have either stagnated or in many cases even declined. And that they have expressed forcibly their dissatisfaction with this system, which can produce wealth for few, but not much of improvement for the vast majority of the world. And so perhaps the
the opposition will come not from the center, but from the outside, and perhaps that's good, because then it'll raise the question very forcibly about what needs to be done in order to make life sensible and viable for the vast majority of people in the world. I should add that there are many solutions to this problem. One is, people can die. There's nothing like zero population growth to remove the pressure of the reserve army of labor. And so death, disease, and war are typically wonderful solutions, as is population control and all of these things which have been put into place. But I think people understand, are beginning to express anyway forcibly, that these mechanisms which have been imposed on them are not going to be tolerated, and we can only hope that that expression gets louder and fiercer over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our second presenter is Tom Pally. Tom was de facto, I guess, not entitled, but de facto chief economist to the AFL-CIO in the 1990s, is now an associate at the New America Foundation. His writings include America's Exhausted Paradigm, Macroeconomic